Hello, my name is Lucy Napa. I'm a postdoctoral fellow at the Center for Behavioral Research and Services at Cal State Long Beach. And as you might guess from the title of my talk, one of the things I'm interested in is issues related to measurement. Before I start, I just wanted to acknowledge some of my co-presenters who are here today, Dennis Fisher, Grace Reynolds, Safiya Beg, and Bridget Rogala. And also to acknowledge our funders. So I'm going to be talking about data from three projects. All three of the projects are funded by SAMHSA grants, and my time is funded by a fellowship from the National Institute on Drug Abuse. So today I'm going to briefly talk to you about some of our experiences using the Addiction Severity Index, or the ASI. I'm going to briefly talk about how we scored the ASI, issues to do with the validity of the ASI, and that includes looking at the relationship between the ASI and another measure of mental health symptoms. So to give you a little bit of background, the Addiction Severity Index is a measure that covers a range of different problem areas. So it looks at problems with health, social problems with alcohol and substance use. And I did a PubMed search before coming here and looked for the search term Addiction Severity Index, and I found over 600 hits that mention the Addiction Severity Index. So that kind of gives you an idea of how widely used this instrument is. It's used both in the US and internationally, and it's been translated into several different languages. So the ASI has six different sections. And for today's talk, I'm only going to be talking about the last section, which is the psychiatric status section, which looks at emotional and psychological problems. And to give you a kind of background to why we're interested in this, there's a lot of research to suggest that in general the ASI is reliable and valid, but there's also some data to suggest that in populations with mental health issues, the ASI might be less reliable and valid, and particularly the psychiatric section might be less reliable and valid in those populations. And we're working with a substance abuse treatment facility that has people accessing drug treatment and also people who are accessing outpatient mental health. And we were kind of interested to look at our data and see how valid is the data we're collecting in these kind of different populations. So in terms of scoring the ASI, there's a variety of ways you can score an ASI. I'm going to be talking about composite scores and interviewer severity ratings, but I just wanted to mention there's other indices called evaluation indices and clinical indices, and I'm going to come back to those at the end of my talk, but I won't be directly talking about them today. So composite scores, when you're scoring an ASI, you can create these composite scores that combine different items. So in the psychiatric section of the ASI, you combine items that look at clients' objective reports of their symptoms. So this could be their reports of whether they've experienced depression in the last 30 days, anxiety in the last 30 days, and also the client's subjective reports of their symptoms. So this is how troubled or bothered they've been by their symptoms and how important they think treatment is for those symptoms. And you'll see at the bottom of there kind of formula for creating these composite scores, and you'll see it's a little bit complicated. It involves weighting the different items and then combining them into a total score. So that's kind of one of the downsides to composite scores is if you're not using a computerized ASI, if you're doing this by hand, it might be a little bit complicated to calculate. On the positive side, composite scores are really useful for looking at change over time because they measure symptoms and problems in the last 30 days. If you want to look at clients coming into your program and then follow them over time to see how they're doing, it gives you a kind of measure of change you can use. So in comparison, interviewer severity ratings, as the name suggests, are ratings that are given by interviewers about how severe they think the client's problems are, and that's in terms of how important they think the client needs for treatment are. So the interviewer, after completing this section, will look at the client's responses, again, both their objective responses about their symptoms and also their subjective responses in terms of how serious they think their symptoms are, and use this information to give a rating. And the ratings are between 0 and 9, with 0 meaning the client doesn't have any real mental health problems and doesn't really need treatment, whereas a 9 would mean this person needs treatment for mental health problems. So the real pros of the interviewer ratings is that they're convenient. The interviewer will rate these when they finish the interview, and then this rating is available right there and then to look and say, does this person need treatment or not? The downside is that these ratings, it's hard to train interviewers to make these ratings reliably. They involve looking at lots of different information and combining this information and coming up with one score. So in general, it's not recommended that these interviewer ratings are used for research purposes or program evaluation, but just because they're convenient, they're often used, for example, in clinical settings where you just want to know, does this person need treatment or not? So comparing these two measures, comparing the composite scores and the interviewer ratings, is one approach to looking at the validity of the ASI. If both these measures are looking at the same thing, if both of these measures are looking at how severe someone's problems are and how much they need treatment, then they should be highly positively correlated. So there was a review a couple of years ago by Michaela that found correlations of between 0.46 and 0.90 for the relationship between composite scores and interviewer ratings. So you'll see there's kind of a broad range there. And there's been some research to suggest that that relationship is affected by staff training. So staff with better training, more training, that correlation is going to be higher. So as I said, we were interested in looking at our data and looking at the validity of these measures in our population that we're looking at. And we wanted to do two things. Firstly is look at that relationship between composite scores and interviewer ratings. And then secondly, look at the relationship between those scores on the Addiction Severity Index and another measure of mental health symptoms. And the measure we looked at was the Symptom Checklist 90. The SDL-90 looks at 9 different dimensions of psychological symptoms and kind of gives us a comparison to look and see, do people who have more symptoms in the SDL-90 get higher composite scores and higher interviewer severity ratings? So as I said, this is data collected from 3 different programs that are all housed under one umbrella substance abuse treatment facility. So they're all in the same overall facility, but they're separate programs. Just over half the data is collected from an outpatient mental health services program that provides mental health services to people living with HIV and AIDS that have co-occurring substance use problems. Then 37% of the data comes from an outpatient drug treatment program that provides drug treatment to primarily African Americans and Latinos and has an emphasis on HIV prevention. And 12% of the data comes from a residential drug treatment program that specifically targets methamphetamine treatment. And I should say the data I'm talking about was collected at baseline. So when people are joining these programs, in each program, ASIs are completed. So you'll see most of our sample are men. Just over 3/4 of them are male. And we have high numbers of Latinos and African Americans with small number of white clients and a very small number of Asian and American Indian clients. So on the ASI, one of the questions is identifying the client's major drug problem. And just to give you an idea of what the sample is like, you'll see the most common drug problem was amphetamine use, followed by alcohol use, cocaine and crack use. We also see high numbers of poly-alcohol drug, poly-drug use problems, too. On this slide here, again, this is data from the ASIs. There's questions on there looking at lifetime psychological problems. And you'll see we have over 60% said that at some point in their life they experienced serious depression. Over half had experienced serious anxiety. 28% had had serious thoughts of suicide. 22% had attempted suicide in the past. And I looked at some national data across drug treatment programs, and these numbers are fairly high compared to kind of averages you might see coming into a program, and that might reflect that we have clients specifically coming in for those mental health services. Okay, so going back to comparing those interviewer ratings to the composite scores. You'll see on the top row there, this is data from all the programs together. And just to go for the composite scores, those on a scale from 0 to 1, and the interviewer ratings are on a scale from 0 to 9. And we see a correlation between the two of 0.78 in our total sample. So this is actually pretty good. We're seeing like a positive correlation between interview ratings and composite scores, suggesting they're measuring the same thing or similar things. So one of the things we're interested in is looking specifically at the clients accessing the mental health services. As I mentioned earlier, there's been some data to suggest maybe this section doesn't work as well in those population. So when we look at the clients accessing the mental health services, across the board, these clients are scoring higher on psychological and emotional symptoms. So these clients have high levels of depression, psychotic symptoms, anxiety, paranoid symptoms. And when we look at the correlation between their composite scores and the interview ratings, we actually see a higher correlation of 0.84. And when you look at the data from those people just accessing the drug treatment programs, there's a correlation of 0.64. So we kind of looked at this and talked about why this might be, and we kind of went back to the issue of staff training, that in these different programs, we have different staff administering the questionnaire, and for us, it's kind of a good indicator of where staff might need more training to administer this measure. Okay, so the next thing we did was we looked at the relationship between the composite scores on the ASI and the interview ratings on the ASI and the data from the symptom checklist. So we're hoping for positive, strong correlations between these measures. And you'll see that across the board, we see strong positive correlations between the composite scores and symptoms like depression, anxiety, psychotic symptoms, paranoid symptoms. And the same for the interview severity ratings. We also see those positive correlations, which suggests that clients who reported more symptoms on the symptom checklist are also getting higher scores on the composite score in the interview ratings, so that clients with more symptoms were being rated as needing more treatment. You'll also notice that across the board, the composite scores tended to have higher correlations with the scores in the SDL-90 than did the interview ratings. So again, this might have something to do with the time frame of these instruments. So the symptom checklist looks at symptoms just in the last 7 days. The composite score looks at problems in the last 30 days. But the interviewer severity ratings, they can involve both symptoms in the last 30 days, but the interviewer can take into account lifetime problems too. So it's looking at slightly different time frames. So just to kind of summarize that for you, looking at our data, we did find evidence for the concurrent validity of the ASI. We found strong positive correlations between the composite scores and the interview ratings, and those strong correlations between the composite scores and the interview severity ratings on the addiction severity index and the scores on the symptom checklist. So people with more symptoms are being rated as needing more treatment. And this was true also for our clients accessing mental health services. So a population that previously has been suggested there may be problems with the ASI, our data suggested that it might provide a useful measure even among people with mental health issues. So just a thought to leave you with. So we were using the fifth edition of the ASI in this program. In the sixth edition of the ASI, it looks like interviewer severity ratings are going to be eliminated. As I mentioned, there's been some problems with them in terms of if people aren't trained well, then they don't tend to be that reliable. And there's been recommendations to use clinical indices instead of interviewer severity ratings. And clinical indices are similar to interviewer ratings in that they combine lifetime measures as well as current symptoms. From our own experiences, one of the things we're interested in doing is looking at these clinical indices and see, you know, how do they relate to the composite scores? How do they relate to our interview severity ratings? There's a lot of information out there in the public domain about calculating composite scores and how to train people to do interview severity ratings, but there's less information out there about these clinical indices. They appear to be good predictors of outcomes, but we're in the process of trying to find out how we can actually score these things and getting more information about it. So that's kind of something for the future, is looking at how these clinical indices work in our data. Thank you.
So I want to thank our presenters very much, both for their timeliness and the wonderful content that they shared with us this morning. They have allowed us a fair amount of time for questions. So what I'd ask is, if there was a question, would ask the presenter to come to the mic, because it is being recorded. I think that'll just be a little easier. So I'll open the floor. Yes.
So the 755 are non-fatal overdoses. So these are people that overdosed, were administered naloxone, and did survive. So those are considered 755 lives saved. We have gotten the 2008 data, which looks like deaths have remained fairly consistent with the 2007 numbers, but because the programs weren't really implemented until the end of 2007, you know, we're not sure quite yet what that means, and we're waiting for the 2009 and 2010 data. So it's a little bit too early to say for sure what the deaths are looking like.
So if I operate that little nasal spray thing, I'm not going to kill anybody.
No.
755, perfect.
Yes, there hasn't been any studies yet on the effects of using naloxone and overdose rates, but there have been studies about the safety of using naloxone, and there's no abuse potential, no problems with any adverse events, so no one's ever been hurt by using naloxone. What they have found is in really high doses of naloxone, especially when it's IV naloxone, that it can induce withdrawal pretty quickly, and so people, when they come out of it, can be a little bit more violent because they've just gone into immediate withdrawal or a little bit sicker, but there's been nothing else besides that. And with the nasal spray, there haven't been those withdrawal symptoms.
So a follow-up question. You had mentioned that insurance was reluctant to cover this device.
Mm-hmm.
Is that complex and that expensive?
Well, I think the part of the issue is because right now it's off-label use by doing it with intranasal. So because there hasn't been studies like the one that we're doing, insurance companies have been resistant to it. It's actually about $3. So for people who have the disposable income, they could potentially buy it themselves. But for predominantly homeless populations, there's not the $3. So with our program, all of that is dispensed for free. And some of the healthcare for the homeless programs are thinking about having the naloxone distributed through their pharmacy, but providing the atomizer themselves. So people are trying to think of creative solutions, but it's also trying to get the insurance companies to start supporting that.
The risk of overdose increases going from transitions, say, where an individual is not able to use, like when they're in a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Can you repeat the question? Because it may have been hard.
And then
sure.
Go out and you use it at the same level. I don't know, could you help?
Sure. The question was, is there an increased risk of overdose at certain time points of coming out of hospitalizations, detoxes, that kind of thing, and then going back to resuming the same levels? Yeah, so that studies have shown that is a really critical time period, that people who have had maybe some abstinence and detox or in prison. When they come out, they try and use the same amounts that they used when they went in, and that's a really high risk for overdose. So that is a critical point. So one of the things that the Massachusetts program is trying to do is to get more into prisons and to detox centers, so to actually train people and distribute that. So when they leave, if they resume their levels, they will know how to use naloxone and they'll be better able to prevent an overdose. So yes, we have seen, it's really sort of any time a long period of abstinence or reduction in use. So any time that they go out and back into the community and start using again, there is, to target those. And that's sort of what our, one of our next steps for the research is finding out for these particular high risk groups, are there ways that you need to change the curriculum to particularly target that? Because I think I said that there's just one curriculum right now. So we're thinking, is there ways that you need to adapt the curriculum for a specific population? So particularly if you went into a prison, is there something that you need to do a little bit differently?
Mm-hmm. I want to ask about the time of protection from the naloxone. I thought naloxone was relatively short-lived versus the opioid.
There is a half-life for naloxone, and I'm sorry, off the top of my head, I don't remember what that is. So part of the reason why two doses are given in the kits is that so the opiates do have a longer life than naloxone. So people can re-overdose without taking any more drugs. So having two doses, you reverse an overdose, they potentially come out of it, and maybe 30 minutes to an hour later, they overdose again. So there's a second dose that you can administer. The hope is that, emergency responders will have been called so that there will be emergency services on present, or the person will be taken to the ER if necessary.
Presumably that would be part of the instructions for using kit.
Yes, it is. Yes, so people are told that that's why they have two doses. If there was a lot of drugs used at one time, sometimes maybe one dose isn't even enough to get people out of the overdose. So one of the things that are collected at the time that people come back and report about the overdoses is, did you have to use both doses? And then what were they taking? So they do try and collect some information about how many doses are typically administered by people when they're out in the community.
Question back to you.
Okay, so the question is about the categorization of the neighborhoods in our study and how we determined disadvantage and then the cutoff that we used for disadvantage. And I guess it also applies to affluent neighborhoods in our sample. So we've done some work validating these measures of neighborhood disadvantage that are composites based on five different indicators of neighborhood proportions of things like income, assets, as well as education and employment. And same thing for the affluence on the other side, looking at indicators of wealth, high education, and professional employment situations. Actually, the cutoff of 25% is defining a neighborhood as either high disadvantage or high affluence was just sort of for convenience sake, but I've also looked at some other analyses looking at defining poor and affluent neighborhoods based on their position being one standard deviation above the mean, for example, on disadvantage or affluence. And the sample sizes are smaller, but the patterns are pretty similar that we found using this cutoff of 25%.
While you're up there, you mentioned that the affluent neighborhoods appear to be protected against alcohol problems. To what extent might that be explained by the reduced density of alcohol retailers around that neighborhood. My impression, correct me if I'm wrong, is that the low-income areas tend to have a higher density of alcohol retailers.
Yes, so the question is about the protective effect that we saw of neighborhood affluence on alcohol-related problems and whether some of the differences between affluent and disadvantaged and middle-class neighborhoods might be due to distributions of alcohol outlets in different kinds of communities. One of the interesting things there that you would think that, well, there's a couple things that might be going on with alcohol outlets. They might be related to higher levels of consumption, which is actually what we do not see in this data, that disadvantaged neighborhoods are actually characterized by lower levels of heavy alcohol use, and rather it's the affluent neighborhoods that are seeing increased volume from both light and heavy drinking. On the other hand, alcohol outlets might be somewhat risky venues, and if some of them involve, for example, outdoor parking lot drinking or something like that, then that you could definitely see how it could be related to certain sorts of consequences, such as legal involvement due to drinking. And in fact, legal and work consequences are the ones that are the most common in our disadvantaged neighborhoods and the ones that are reduced in more affluent areas. So there definitely is a role for looking at some of these other factors, such as outlet distributions, for sure.
There's a question in the back.
Absolutely. So, yes, they are trained to call 911 and ways in which to call so that if you say, for example, you know, there's someone, they're not breathing, could you send help? But if you say someone's overdosed, then police are likely to get involved. So they train people on, you know, what to say when they're calling 911. But there's still a lot of fear around police coming and involvement. So that's one of the big barriers we found. And so that's why the state's really trying to push the Good Samaritan law, getting that passed. It's been in the House and the Senate, and as far as I know, it was going along pretty well, and then with the elections, it sort of stalled right now. So we're hopeful that it'll come back on the agenda. So I'm not really sure where it stands, but there is a bill in both the House and the Senate in Massachusetts to try and get that passed.
I live in California, and I see the 911 good channel bill my organization did in California this year. Unfortunately, it's a better governor, but we'll have a different governor next year, so we're planning to bring it back if anyone in California wants to be involved. And Washington State passed one this year, and then Illinois has one.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of states right now are trying to get that through, so that's I think that's an important piece for overdose prevention. Oh, that's great. Thank you.
We have a few more minutes for other questions.
Just an additional question. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about the training, because I know that it involves more than just handing out the locks and how to identify those breathing. Could you talk to us more about that?
Sure. It's about an hour-long training, and so there's usually a nurse or another community worker that comes in and will do the training. And so they talk about people's experiences with overdoses in the training. So they try and bring out sort of what are some myths. Have you heard of shooting milk into someone who's overdosing? And so sort of going through what the myths out there are and then what sort of are proven techniques. So they spend a lot of time going through that. How do you see when someone's just nodding out versus really going through an overdose? So they go through a lot of what those signs and symptoms are. How do you properly administer rescue breathing? They always have sample naloxone sprays because it comes unassembled, so you have to assemble it. So they make sure they go through person by person that they know how to actually put together the naloxone kit. And then there also is a lot of information that's included. So they give it's a fairly good size kit, which includes the two naloxone doses, the atomizer. They get matches with prevention messages on it, more detailed instructions. So there's a lot of things that go in the kit. And they also have this 911 piece about how you can call emergency services. And then, you know, at the time they ask if people are actively using, if they're interested in treatment, there's an opportunity for a little bit of case management and helping people get in to services if they need them.
Dr. Shaheen, you mentioned that, or you showed us evidence that exposure to cannabinoids appears to decrease risk of diabetes mellitus, but you also showed that increasing dose was associated with less protection.
That's right.
Am I correct?
That's right.
Might it be that the mode of use could affect the benefits? Humans can use marijuana either in a smoked form or in a non-smoked form. So the benefits may not be outweighed by the deleterious effects of being exposed to smoke if they use the non-smoked form. Is there data from the animal literature or other data that you know that might help to disentangle the effects of the modality of use?
Thank you very much. This is a very good question. Actually, we are there is a potential or a possibility that this could happen, that the modality and the actual consumption, the amount itself could have an influence on this association. In the enhanced data 3, we did not have the availability of the data or the luxury to do that. So there is an animal study that's ongoing right now to test the different levels and amount, but also different modality. But we did not get yet the preliminary data. The data just being approved by the Institutional Review Board and started last month. So we are still in the data collection phase for that. But there is a big potential that this could be. The other data that's available from the references and previous studies did not talk about the actual amount or the influence of this on whether association or whether inhibition of the cannabinoid receptors or stimulation of the cannabinoid receptors. So we're going to be pioneering in getting this animal study in progress and get this data. I will be happy, if you will be interested, I will be happy to get your information. Once we have this data, I will be happy to share the results with everybody.
I'm afraid that we really are at 4:00, and to be respectful to presenters and other folks, I'm afraid we'll have to close. I do want to thank the presenters. The information that was brought forward, yeah, really.